Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and, of course, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly, the films Rewind and Play, Filmmakers for the Prosecution, and Juniper.
Got a couple of documentaries I would like to talk about today, both of which are very worthwhile, and then a fiction movie called Juniper, which I'm afraid is not so worthwhile. But let's begin with the documentaries, with the more positive material here. Rewind and Play. It's just a little over an hour long, and it's about the great, 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 I can't say great often enough, jazz musician, jazz pianist Thelonious Monk, one of the greatest jazz musicians in my mind who ever lived, and probably the greatest jazz pianist who ever lived, who not only was just an astoundingly great musician, but it changed the sound of jazz in really important ways back during the great bebop era, especially in the 50s and 40s, just did enormously important things in the music and was a totally charismatic performer who did astounding work. So anyway, enough of my gushing about Thelonious Monk, but he is the subject of this movie, which was made for French television. That is, the footage was shot for French television way back in 1969. Thelonious Monk had been touring around Europe, and he was getting to the end of his tour, and he was a widely celebrated jazz musician at that time. He had been on the cover of Time magazine a few years earlier, again, back in the great bebop era, and he had now been touring around Europe, and he was just getting to the end of this tour, and it was getting near the end of his musical career, too. He stopped playing, performing at least, maybe around a year or so after this was done, but this was in 1969. And there he is. He's just finishing up this tour of Europe, and he's in France. And French television, the official French state television station, wants to do an interview with him. So he does this interview with official French television. And unfortunately, it turns out that the interviewer is just really not a good interviewer. And that is what this movie, which we are now seeing, this new movie, Rewind and Play, takes its footage from that interview that was done, but not from the interview itself, from the filming of that interview way back in 1969 for French television. And what we see is the really bad interviewing that was done of poor Thelonious Monk, who was doing his best to cope with this, but the interviewer doesn't seem to know what he is really after. He seems to be steering the interview in various ways, and he doesn't seem to be exactly sure where he is steering it, and he's vague, and he doesn't like the answers that Thelonious Monk is giving him, and so, oh my gosh, it just turns into a very awkward and embarrassing situation for poor Thelonious Monk, and for the interviewer, who doesn't seem to realize how badly it's going. And by the time the whole thing is over, the thing was finally finished, and apparently Monk didn't get to speak very much during it. But anyway, it's about a badly done interview way back in 1969. So why is this of interest now? Well, some people are saying it's of interest now because it is exposing racism in the media, that this was all an example of a racist interviewer just almost deliberately doing a bad job of interviewing Thelonious Monk. Well, I really disagree with that view, and here is why. This is being done, this show is being made back in 1969 for French state television, and France has a long and honorable history of being extremely welcoming and supportive of American jazz musicians, black American jazz musicians. Many black American jazz musicians went to France at one time or another during their careers for a greater or shorter length of time and were welcomed and treated like the royalty they were. So I don't think this is racism going on here. I think it's just bad, bad interviewing going on. And I also think that what this movie is worth seeing now for, first of all, you do get to see Thelonious Monk play for a while, and that's worth anything. But also, because this is a good example of media manipulation. Even today, how we see these interviews with famous artists and people like that on television, on cable, on the internet, wherever, they are all put together and edited, and the questions are formed in certain ways, and they are all manipulating the subject all the time. And here we see that manipulation taking place, courtesy of this very bad interviewer who was doing such a bad and transparent job of manipulating poor Thelonious Monk. By the way, Monk does not seem to me to be at his best in this either. I have a feeling that he had had more than a few drinks and was not parrying the questions and comments of that bad interviewer very well. So nobody comes out very well of this except Monk when he actually plays the piano, and he is then superb as always. So Rewind and Play is looking worth looking at now, I think, just first as an archival document. Documentary and document of Thelonious Monk at a certain point nearing the end of his career, but still very much in it, and also as a good example of media manipulation laid bare. If you're interested in jazz, if you're interested in Monk, it is not to be missed. And if you're interested in media, I really think everybody ought to see it. Turning to our next documentary, it also has to do with archives, Filmmakers for the Prosecution, an unusual title. And I will mention this movie is a squeak under an hour long. Almost always the movies that I talk about for Films in Focus are feature films more than an hour long. This just barely qualifies as a short film, but it's about an hour long, and it is really, really worth seeing. French production, directed by Jean-Christophe Klotz, and it is just fascinating. Again, Filmmakers for the Prosecution, an unusual title, but that is exactly what it is about. We are back here in 1945 at the very end of World War II. And of course, the Nazis committed all kinds of war crimes, and then there was the Holocaust. I'm sure the most horrific crime of the 21st century, of the 20th century, and many other centuries. And the Allied forces who won the war against Nazi Germany are preparing for the famous war crimes tribunal at Nuremberg, a trial. And interestingly, they wanted this to be a fair trial, and I think it's always worth mentioning, not all of the defendants were convicted of what they were accused of. Most were, but not every single one. And certainly not everybody who was found guilty was sentenced to the most severe sentence they could have been sentenced to. So even with the horrifying nature of the crimes, the war crimes, the Holocaust crimes, it was a fair trial, and it was intended to be a fair trial. So when you are wanting to give a fair trial, you are wanting to present as persuasive evidence of the crimes as you possibly can. And that is what the Allied forces set about to do. And of course, then as now, some of the most persuasive trial evidence that you can possibly come up with is filmed evidence. So the War Crimes Tribunal, and by the way, one of the people who was very much involved in that, setting up that tribunal, was John Ford, one of the greatest Hollywood filmmakers, got together a couple of young Hollywood people named Budge Schulberg and Stuart Schulberg, and they really were from the movies. Their father, B.P. Schulberg, was a very major Hollywood mover and shaker, going back to the days of silent films and the early decades of sound films. So they had really grown up with Hollywood. And they were brought on to find film footage that would be persuasive evidence of horrific Nazi crimes. And it had to be a rushed job. So they spent a few months traveling around Europe looking for this kind of film footage, most of it made by the Nazis themselves, who now were doing everything they possibly could to destroy any evidence that could be used against them. So sometimes as they went on their search, the Schulberg brothers found that the material had just been destroyed. One place they went to, it was the film was literally on fire at that moment. At another point, they went to a salt mine where some of the footage had been stashed away. They went all over. A lot of the footage had been destroyed, but they did manage to come up with a fair amount of film footage. And then also on a total rush job, they had to edit it into some form that could be shown at the trial. And it was shown at the trial. The courtroom was altered, so the big screen would have the most prominent position, and the evidence could be shown on the screen in the most persuasive way. So all of that was done. And this movie is about the search for the footage and about how it was used in the trial. However, that's not all. Because then Bud Schulberg went back to Hollywood, went back to America, but Stuart Schulberg was still there and was then given the job of filming the trial itself, which had never been done before. Now, the trial, the hearings, the proceedings went on for almost a year, and Schulberg and his tiny crew were only able to shoot about a day and a half of material over the course of almost a year. But they were able to use a couple of two or three cameras. one was handheld and was over on the side, and another one was on a fixed tripod and was sort of in the middle, and they were able to film a fair amount of material and then put this together also into a documentary. And ultimately, this material of the trial was put together into its own documentary. So there was the Nazi war crimes evidence that was shown at the trial, which both of the Schulberg brothers put together. And then there was a documentary using filmed footage of the trial itself that Stuart Schulberg put together. And then fascinatingly and unfortunately, the American authorities then decided not to show that documentary of the trial when it was finished because they were trying to denazify Germany. They didn't want to embarrass or humiliate the German people any more than necessary. So they decided that that documentary should not be shown, and certainly not in Germany. So it was a fascinating end to this whole situation. But all of this is what Filmmakers for the Prosecution is about. It is about the somewhat successful search for documentary evidence that could be used against the Nazis in the trial proceedings, and then about the filming of the trial itself. It's a fascinating movie, always important to revisit this material, and Filmmakers for the Prosecution, brief though it is, at about an hour long, is just overloaded with fascinating material. Some of it's pretty horrifying to watch, but all of it really, really an important reminder of what went on in that extremely fraught period of world history. And for our final movie today, that's two documentaries. We turn to our fiction film, and I'm afraid I found it dull and dreary. I can't recommend it, but since it's out there, people want to know about this dull and dreary film, so I'll talk a little bit about it. It's called Juniper. It's never clear in the movie why it's called Juniper, although it's possible I missed something. It was written and directed by Matthew J. Saville. It comes from New Zealand, and it stars Charlotte Rampling. And most of the good buzz about this movie centers on the fact that Charlotte Rampling, who is getting on in years, is still able to give a fine performance, and she still has energy, and she's still a fine screen artist and all of that. And I support that. She is wonderful, although I don't think she's especially good in this movie. It's wonderful to see an actor of her years still around and still making major films. Well, not that I consider this a major film, but it's this feature film, and it's out there. So here's what it's about. We have a teenager whose name is Sam, and he's a little bit troubled. You know, he parties with his friends. He's been in trouble at school, stuff like that. And he has a father named Robert. Robert's father, Sam's grandmother, has come to live with them at their home in New Zealand because she is having problems. For one thing, she's a total alcoholic. And for another thing, she broke her leg recently. So she really needs a lot of care. Now, Robert, the father, her son, goes away right away. He has things to do elsewhere, so he's not around for most of the movie, which leaves his teenage son, Sam, who never asked for this assignment and is not very well qualified to do it, to look after his grandmother, Ruth. There's also a nurse who's there on the premises, but she's not all that responsible, and she takes off for long periods of time. So poor teenage Sam, the irresponsible youth, is mostly in charge of taking care of his ailing alcoholic grandmother, Ruth. So obviously the relationship between them almost immediately becomes somewhat strained, and it's embarrassing for both of them when he has to help her to the bathroom and stuff like that. And in the meantime, she's drinking and drinking, and he's doing his best to look after her and also to lead a little bit of his own life. She turns out to be a feisty old woman, and she encourages some of his worst tendencies. At one point, for example, she decides that the property around the house, these people have a fair amount of money, the property around the house needs to be cleaned up. It's all messy. There's junk strewn around. So she hires a bunch of Sam's teenage friends, offering to pay them off with liquor. Not a very responsible thing to do. Hey, you know, it works. The place gets cleaned up. They get their booze, and everybody is more or less happy. So she's a feisty old woman. She is not, shall we say, one to hold up the traditional proprieties. And in some way, she encourages Sam in his own rebelliousness, which is kind of interesting. So that's what the movie is about. Why do I consider it not a very good movie? It is just dull. Almost nothing interesting happens in this movie. It takes very little time to establish the premise that Sam is an unruly teenager, somewhat unruly. He's not really that unruly. And that Ruth is a feisty old lady. Yeah, she's somewhat feisty, but hey, she drinks a lot and she's stuck in a chair because of a broken leg, so she can't be that feisty. So we get that settled up early in the movie, and then we're just sort of seeing variations on it for the next hour and a half. Also, now a complaint about Charlotte Rampling. We find out fact, she drinks a bottle of booze every single day. What she drinks is the special drink she insists Sam make for her, half water and half sheer alcoholic beverage. And she drinks one of these every day. We never see the slightest sign of inebriation in Ruth. She talks. She, by the way, in her earlier life, she was a fabulously important professional war photographer. She talks about her past. She reminisces. She discusses. She interacts with Sam. And she never, ever once seems drunk, inebriated, or intoxicated. This must be a strategy on the part of the filmmakers, perhaps to allow the character to maintain her dignity. But, oh, it totally interferes with the credibility, with the plausibility, with the believability of this movie. So, Charlotte Rampling is good to see. I can't say it's a good performance by her. And the movie as itself, I gotta repeat, is dull, dreary, and just not interesting. So go with those documentaries. Go with Filmmakers for the Prosecution. Go with Rewind and Play. Don't go with Juniper. It's a very disappointing experience. And that is my partly documentary story this week.
For which we thank you forever and always, David Sterrett, Films in Focus, the films Rewind and Play, Filmmakers for the Prosecution, and Juniper.